So here, why don't we hand out, you want to hand those out so everybody's got them. So we've got, so these two groups are around market facilitation, customer experience, and regulatory. We got about, the way we set it up is an hour on market facilitation, customer experience, a half an hour on regulatory. Let's see how we go because we can adjust that to make sure we get the best use of everybody's time. And if there's more energy around regulatory, we can flip over. So, but we've pulled together this poster board really to start the dialogue. And really, you know, the intent of this is really to talk about, you know, where the utility, where the distribution utility can and should play in the future. And are there opportunities in terms of either developing new offerings or facilitating other entrants participating and providing other offerings to the market? So I'm not going to read everything that's on here, but it's about, you know, how, you know, what's the difference for the customer, and from their perspective, you know, looking at the additional services available as they're either participating in providing distributed energy resources, or energy back to the grid, how they're buying off the grid as a platform provider, whether or not we can start talking about energy efficiency and demand response as, you know, previously services that were the, you know, would be provided through an aggregator. Is that something that an end-use customer can and should be providing in the future? And how would that be managed, and what's the role of the distribution utility in that? Should they be helping to facilitate that marketplace? Should they be participating in that marketplace? And how do you manage across that? So, you know, we talk about, in terms of offerings, you've got, you know, the potential in terms of the wholesale market, and we could talk about both residential and C&I customers for the purpose of this discussion, where you may have larger C&I that would actually consider participating in the wholesale market to the distribution network and the back and forth that you would see. And then how does that actually relate to electric vehicles and the impact that those vehicles will have on the marketplace?
Other than that, we don't have much to do.
Other than that, it'll be a real simple discussion. So we actually...
And you guys already have the answer, right? So you just...
It's B. It's B. So we're trying to think about the timing in terms of, you know, what's going to happen in the next 5 years and what's going to happen in the next 10 years. And I know we talked a lot earlier today about 2040 and 2050, but we want to try to get a little bit more real in this discussion about what can and should we as either utilities or as providers do in the near term. So the first question about, you know, how will the role of the distribution utility change? And I want to actually make sure everybody has the chance to see some of the other things on here. I actually skipped over the capabilities discussion. And these are intended to be representative. I don't want you to look at this and go, this is an answer, because it's not an answer. It's one point of view that's actually intended to provoke discussion and not provide the output of where we should be going with this. But we've talked to a number of our clients that say, I want to be a platform provider. And I'm honestly not sure how everybody defines a platform provider. But I know that if I talk to six different people, I probably get six different answers on what a platform provider is. Around optimization of energy, I think that's a natural role for a utility to play. But how do you actually, what are the services that you're actually providing when you talk about an energy optimization? And are you developing new capabilities, or is this more of, you know, the consistent energy efficiency programs that we're offering already, as well as the network services that are provided through a TSO or a distribution dispatch operations model? And then from a settlement system, if there's settlement on top of these services, how is that going to work? So I like to throw a lot of spaghetti. But I want to, the purpose of this is really to get your thoughts and start getting the discussion going and see what we can get down on paper. We put yellow stickies in front of everybody so you can.
And this is mostly IOU or both public, because we have a public
co-op here. Yeah, I know it's a little bit, I think we've been a little bit more IOU-centric skewed in the discussion, but from a public perspective, like to actually, layer on what you're thinking and where you see yourselves participating as well. Yeah, I think the intent was to have more than one public utility, or two if you count that.
I think you have two.
Yeah. Oh. One distribution, one generation.
Let me say something real short, okay. So hopefully I won't distract us too much, but I was going to say this earlier, and so I saved it for this,
okay.
Which is, last week I was talking to some state regulators, a few. I was at the NAREC meeting, and one of the interesting conversations for about 10 minutes short was, and I'm loosely paraphrasing, but, over the last number of decades, 5, 6, 7 decades, we've had this implicit compact with customers that says, we're going to provide you affordable, reliable, and safe electricity. And you can use as much as you want, and basically anywhere you want, and we'll give it to you, And for good or for bad, the utilities have proven that we could do that, right? It's like, oh yeah, we've done a really good job of doing exactly that. And so now, it's almost like we're saying, oh, well, it's more complicated than that. So now, Mr. Consumer, you got to turn your lights off sometimes, and you got to turn your thermostat down sometimes, and we can only do the affordable, safe, reliable power if you do all these things. And by the way, in order to get you to do that, we're going to incentivize that by giving you exorbitant peak rates at certain times, and we're going to whatever. So all of a sudden the consumer's like, what the heck?
Yep.
I thought you guys were good at this, right? I don't want to do any of this. Mm-hmm. I want you to do that. And it's almost like that we need to, our goal is to get back to that same place. So in 20 years, in 2040, we obviously are going to have a much different system with renewables and all that kind of stuff. But from the consumer standpoint, they still just want affordable, safe, reliable, and maybe now clean electricity. And everything else, I could care less. If I got an EV, I want to be able to charge it. I don't want to worry about when I charge it or even necessarily where I charge it. It's that kind of mindset. And from a regulator viewpoint, that's kind of where some regulators are at. It's like, oh, wait a minute, now you guys are telling me this is way more complicated than it's ever been before, and now we have to worry about all these nuances, and is technology going to do this or that, and how's the competitive market going to impact it, and what's the role of the utility, right? So suddenly it's so complicated that regulators almost don't want to have to even deal with it, right?
Yeah, I would argue that, to a great extent, customers want comfort and convenience. And that's what customers have always wanted. They want comfort and convenience, and some are willing to pay more for it, and some are willing to pay less. But that's what they want, whatever their level of affordability, or whatever their price point they're going to be talking about. So we talk about energy as a low-interest commodity, because I think people don't really care about their electric usage, they care about what they're using it for and whether it makes their life easier and how it makes their life easier. And you do have the sustainability overlay today, which I would say is becoming more and more of both an issue and an opportunity, in that now people, not that people previously didn't care about clean energy.
No, they didn't care. They care now more because obviously it's a growing global and social situation, but it's also forefront in marketing and TV ads and everything else.
Right.
They're told what to care about.
Right.
I totally agree with your comments, Steve. I find them interesting because if you think about customers and regulators to a large part, and I'll blame the regulators more than the customers just because it feels better, have made it more complicated. I mean, it's funny.
Yeah.
We all go back to forget any kind of artificial subsidies and pricing pressures, where literally straight usage drew that even line across all the cost of the assets that have to go in, whether that's generation, whether that's distribution, whether that's transmission, et cetera. And then you do your normal rate area to spread that across. I mean, that's the whole point of a regulated monopoly. It wasn't to empower some corporation. It was, frankly, to make power affordable and available for those that otherwise couldn't pay for it. I mean, that's honestly, obviously, what we're holistically subsidizing. And the only thing that made it complicated now was the, I want my cake and eat it too. I want the full backing of the utility, but I'm going to go ahead and generate my power, which then skews off all the economics. And then you add in the regulatory piece of artificially subsidizing things because you want green power to take over. So again, I'm not blaming the intent or the reason, but those are the effects, in fact, that have made it complicated, because now those equations, the standard nice easy equations, use as much as you want, whenever you want, you have a set rate, it works, and it works fairly. Now we're all broken. And that's what gets us now into that situation of, you know, for us in Arizona, instituting demand rates and trying to start to really, the end goal is decoupling the, you still got to pay for the system. We're fine if you want to generate and your own power and therefore cut off the fuel costs and the generation costs once we pay for assets already in the ground.
Yeah.
Not to overcomplicate that statement, but again, that's what breaks that equation.
In fairness, I should let Cameron take the antithesis, right, or whatever, because the flip of that is competitive markets have come along and provided a huge amount of innovation that we probably never would have had under the old paradigm, right? So it's not that it's a bad thing; it is a good thing. But this tension now that it's created between how do you make sure the competitive markets continue to enable innovation and better efficiency and cleaner energy and all those good things that it brings, but still not break the basic paradigm.
What I would say is a lot of technology innovation has changed the economics, so that another thing contributing to breaking the system is the fact that economies of scale are different. And so a lot of where we started was built on economies of scale. Bigger is better, bigger is cheaper, bigger is going to create a better social outcome. And I think it's, either that isn't true anymore, or there are a lot of people who don't think that that's true anymore.
It's point two.
What's that?
It's point two.
Yeah.
Because either way.
If you talk about this distributed solar, when we just ran an RFP to get an idea of what we were talking about, if we wanted to do distributed projects throughout our four communities, or if you want to build 150 megawatts of solar, it's 2.5 times.
Yeah.
So it's a reality versus perception. That's the reality of the cost. Where I'm at, that may not be the same everywhere, but that is the reality.
Yeah, and I'm not intending to be an arbiter of reality. I mean, all I would say is on the public record and being presented in front of commissioners and as part of public discourse, there are a lot of different numbers out there that present different forms of reality. All of them consistently, I think, would agree on the idea that technology innovation has dramatically either lowered or introduced new options for consumers. And so part of what's breaking in the system, in my view, is not so much the operations, it's the investment into the system. So where, in vertically integrated markets, all of the capital investment is controlled and sort of flows through the utility, and now you've got this growing pool of investment that's coming either directly from consumers or from all the companies that are trying to service consumers. Whether it's Tesla or Nest or whomever else, that are investing in systems that provide a lot of capabilities. So, again, I'm not here to say, well, I think I've got the answer, because I certainly don't. He does. So that's convenient. but I think a piece that, and I've mentioned this to you before, a piece that I think is really relevant to bring into this conversation is competitive markets and competitive mechanisms are being introduced and being considered and being advocated for. And I don't see that slowing down.
I agree.
So I think you're going to get, at the distribution level, I think you're going to get a lot more calls for, and even baking into some policy, like I know Washington and their distribution system planning considerations, above some certain cost thresholds, they haven't codified yet, the utility would be required to go out and do a competitive solicitation, or at least some non-wires alternative solicitation to say, we're thinking of this $5 million investment here. Anybody else got better ideas? So that sort of, it begins to open up the market for distribution system investments in a way that breaks the system.
And I think on a level playing field, I think those are great. I mean, we've been looking at NWAs for a long time. I love the idea of being able to state, okay, let's do a holistic RFP that takes into account those other resources. What we run into then is on the policy regulatory side, though, you don't end up apples to apples comparison. So it's okay for somebody to bid in a product, using these very generalized terms on purpose, that doesn't have near the reliability or the availability or anything that a utility version would. And again, I'm also not advocating the utility is always right, so don't take my words to mean that, although I obviously work for utility.
Oh, clear.
But you've got to even that playing field. It's okay, fine, if the cost is this for the utility version and that means 100% reliability, and yeah, the cost is cheaper for Susie's house rooftop, but by the way, the availability is only 26%, again, making up numbers, then fine, let's equate those across, and then you can make the decision across those. And so I think that's also that hard part, is how do you really understand what the expectations are and what the specifications are across the gamut of solutions, and then apply them equally.
So what is the what's the role of the distribution utility in playing through that? I mean, how do you, you know, you can sit there and say, okay, we're gonna present our NWA, non-wire alternative solutions to the regulator, and we'll present our capital plan to the regulator and let them decide, or we can present what we think is the best solution.
I would never let a regulator decide.
Yeah. So how do you get ahead of it? What can you do to get ahead of it?
I can tell you we did in California. We worked really hard for a process that gave us a lot of reasonable screens of what projects are eligible for deferral and what are not. And so one of the challenges that may be coming is that it's actually a really small number that really makes sense. And a lot of people think there's going to be this huge market, but there's actually not this huge market. And even for the projects that look technically good, in that it's like a reconductoring where peak load reduction from a few batteries could solve it pretty well, it doesn't necessarily mean it's economical. And so this, we've done it twice now. So we have two projects that are being built now to defer a circuit upgrade. But the most recent round, we didn't sign any contracts because none of the bids that we got were in the money relative to the wire solution. We didn't think they were going to be, because we sort of looked at what the wire solution was and they weren't that expensive. And it's just, you know, it can be hard to beat the humble copper wire in terms of just cost effectiveness. But
in the school of perception, then you're going to get beat up to death on it. Again, people perceive that there's a gigantic solution.
Yeah.
Or in the solution set, sorry.
And it's very cheap.
You know, we'll see what happens when we, when people start complaining that we didn't do enough. But, you know, people will see the numbers and they'll see that, you know, for some of these deferral needs, like they were just, the circuit would need to be unloaded for, you know, 8 hours a day, most days of the summer. And, you know, a non-wireless alternative solution just doesn't really work for that very well.
I think back to your question, you know, personally, I think the distribution utilities have the 100 plus, 120 plus, wherever you live, years of experience on this. Mm-hmm. And so I think where we need to come to the table is we need to be very open and transparent about the specifications and the requirements and say, look, this is what it has to do. It has to cover 8 hours, 4 days a year, if that's what it is, or 8 hours X days, versus that's got to be very reliable and we're very safe and we're wonderful because we're a utility. I mean, that's kind of the playing field we've been on for decades, because no one was going to argue with us. Now I think it's incumbent on us to be able to take our knowledge and take our engineering skills and say, okay, fine, you know what? Here are the exact specs. Here's exactly what's got to cover. Here's the traits it has to have. Here's the whatever. And be able to openly, honestly, and transparently put that out there and do comparisons across those. I think that's what we have to do as a distribution utility in order to even play in this field. I mean, and frankly, I think it's the right thing for us to do to play in this field.
And that's more or less what we do in California now. Not all of it we wanted to do, some of it we were told to do, but we actually have a report every year that goes out identifying the distribution deferral opportunities with the specifications that a distributed solution would need to meet it, frequency, duration, all that.
Do you do some kind of locational pricing, like for where to site these DERs? Or?
So we have a separate thing where we have maps that one shows integration capacity available on every circuit, and secondly shows an estimate of locational value for a commercial project that was going to get sited at that point, based on assumptions about how much they can make in the market and other factors.
Kind of price signals out there.
Back to your question of the role, it seems like one of the key roles that gets talked about, like what you just said, it's talked about but not explicit, which is the new distribution system of the future has much better data, much more accurate data, much more comprehensive data. And if the models are created to use that data, you now have a much better ability to predict and plan for these kinds of situations, and that's a perfect role for the utility, right? And then the question of who owns and operates these assets or whatever, that's the next thing to answer, right?
But
but there's nobody better to do the analysis and to the planning than the utility. And that should be, in my mind, it's not recognized enough that that's an explicit role that's evolving.
I mean, a little bit interesting to see in California is if third parties try to do some of that or try to get more and more into the weeds of the distribution planning process.
No, we're watching that happen right now.
Yeah, they will.
Yeah. The planning. Are you having others who have come in and try to take the planning away from you?
What? Yeah, we've had, I mean, even just activist citizens come in and say, you know, you need to turn over your model to us. We want to take this on. And by the way, we've hired some consultant for, you know, $2,000 who's going to run your resource planning for the future. But they're you laugh.
Right, but yeah.
They're serious.
Right.
I mean, they're very, very serious.
I think the other challenge with the non-wires alternatives is you're approaching a capacity constraint, and then the question is, how do you avoid capacity uplifts? Why are you avoiding? If I'm a solar developer, don't avoid the capacity uplift. Do the capacity uplift and allow me to do non-wire alternatives.
And don't charge me or my customers for the capacity uplift. Thank you very much.
Exactly.
Spread that out to the rest of your
customers. So that's a concern for us as well when you are opening up some of the planning, is you assume that, okay, people are going to go where it makes sense to go, but then you'll just be loaded up there and you'll need more capacity uplift. So as soon as you tell people where you have circuit availability or you have availability capacity, that will be loaded up. Mm-hmm. And then there'll be a queue there, and people will be frustrated with you there. Mm-hmm. And then you'll, you know, have a non-wires alternative location that you could propose, and that'll get loaded up, and you'll still need the capacity uplift.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that is, who pays for it? And if it's the, you know, customer that doesn't participate, or, you know, isn't really interested in any of this, they would potentially pay for it and not really feel any benefit for doing
right.
it.
Right.
Yeah, I'm involved in the Ohio Power Forward Planning Working Group, where we have, First Energy, around from AEP and Dayton, and then, you know, with the commission and some third-party stakeholders and stuff, and we have a lot of discussion around non-wire alternatives. And the challenge in Ohio is a lot of those value streams just don't exist for the highly regulated distribution utilities. Mm-hmm. So the only value for them is really potentially a deferral of a planning problem. And right now, the cost of those technologies is are not competitive against the traditional solutions. So there's no value for Plato Edison or Ohio Columbus Southern for, you know, potentially solving a transmission congestion issue or participating in, you know, a PJM frequency regulation market. So that's meaningless to the utility.
So say more about that, just because you can't earn a rate of return on it, or?
Yeah, I mean, the utilities are, you're looking at your capital constrained utility, right?
Sure.
You only have so much of your capital budget to spend. So you have a planning problem. I got an overloaded substation transformer.
Sure.
You know, I could potentially, you know, maybe rebuild another adjacent circuit and transfer load over to it is one solution, or maybe I need to build a new feeder, replace a transformer, build a new substation, or I could look at potentially procuring DER as a solution. You know, I may have demand response options, I may be able to put in a battery storage that maybe I can only get value out of it maybe 20 hours of the year as a peak shaving. system. But that's it. There's no other value associated with that for that utility. But if I can go ahead and invest into that and put a capital investment into, you know, placing a transformer, building a new circuit, at least I can get that return through my rate process.
But so it's a financial issue, not so much a system optimization issue.
Right? Until you unlock those value streams, that doesn't exist right now for us.
Understood. You know, I see your point. But like for a G&T or a co-op, that's not the issue because they don't have a rate of return. And so they're looking for
nice.
The most optimal thing to do, right?
I've worked for both. And
yeah.
I mean, I'm just sort of making an observation about what I hear in this discussion, which is kind of interesting in going back to the role. What's the role of the utility? I think it feels like from some of what you've described it, and you, I would say, I think you've both expressed, like, these people don't understand, they're getting it wrong, they've got bad information. And I would say it almost doesn't matter, they're going to keep coming.
Yeah.
I agree.
And so then the response, and I think a lot of people feel this in sort of the angst in the industry, which is, oh, the utility is sort of fighting our desire to get access to this information, and they're being obstructionists.
Sure.
And I imagine there's a lot of sort of embedded cultural sort of antibodies that would say, we've done this for 100 years, so stay out of our business, we know what we're doing. But I doubt that's going to be a successful strategy.
No.
So it feels like you need to really embrace something that at least feels like transparency for the people on the other side.
No,
so that they don't, either they don't hire that consultant.
Oh, they're going to hire them anyway.
Well, fine. But then they agree with what you put forward. I mean, California certainly has this. Of like, you're putting forward stuff in a way that makes people feel like it's as transparent as can be.
Yeah, man.
This is what I would say on the flip side of that. We have completely changed how we do business. I would have said 5 years ago, no one had any idea who the company I worked for even was.
Right.
People would drive past it. Most people had no idea.
Yeah.
You know, we've been doing some surveying lately. So we've been in the news a lot and had a lot of community outreach events.
Yeah.
You know, we've really changed our tactics in terms of, we're a generation and transmission company. Mm-hmm. So I don't deal with the end user customer on a very regular level, but now everyone is very interested in our resource mix. We have pretty lofty decarbonization goals based on the goals of 3 of my 4 owner communities. So we've done a number of outreach. It does not matter. So we have a 2030 goal. I was at a meeting on Tuesday night last week, and now that's not good enough. We just made this goal in December. Now they want 2025. I'm at the next city council meeting. They want 2022. And the next one is, why aren't we 100% zero carbon today? So what I would say to you is, yes, I think that utilities as a whole, working in utility communications, are terrible communicators. We're trash, we're filth, we're awful at it. I mean, it's what I do for a living, and we're awful at it. I'm telling you, we're terrible. But I have found that the more we do it, it does not change. Right now, there is a huge, and I don't care what business you work in there, if you are considered government, big business, there is a huge mistrust between the aspects of the general public, fringe left or fringe right, whichever way you want to swing, on whether they believe what that is. You can be the Department of Energy, you can be the EPA, you can be the CDC, the WHO, you can be energy as a whole. I think we're at a point tipping right now where the question becomes perception real or is reality real?
They trust Twitter and Google.
I think that question's been answered.
Or fat Harry's block.
I think we're past the thing. I think we've gotten the answer.
But I mean, we've gone a completely different direction. We now survey in our 4 communities, even though I don't directly serve them. We hold open houses. We're going through an integrated resource plan right now where, you know, typically they've held one meeting where the public comes and they don't get a talk. We've opened them up. They're 4 hours. You can talk, you can say, you can ask, you can do whatever you want at the microphone. I don't limit your time at all. I just let you wear yourself out, right? But we've gone this completely different, and I'm not finding it less angsty. I'm finding it more angsty. It's an odd situation right now.
So you say building trust, you put it in the 5-year horizon there.
It has to be.
Critical with stakeholders.
It has to be.
And it's just a reminder, if you want to jot down some of the thoughts that you have.
We do.
It's pretty clear that they want us to do the writing. That's okay. That's what we're here for.
And so I agree with Cameron with your point around, and I also agree from the standpoint that it's not easy, but transparency mm-hmm. has just got to be the way of life. And again, it won't necessarily say that they won't hire the...
Sure.
Because they're going to for us to, but at least it's out there. And I do believe, you know, X number of years ago, I don't even know how many at this point, you know, certainly we would have not wanted to do that for a variety of reasons, whether it was the antibodies of 120 years or fear or whatever. None of that matters anymore. You've got to be transparent. You've got to be open. And you know what? You've got to be welcoming and or at least willing to hear the challenges and just deal with them.
So
it feels like, well, I was just going to say, to build on that, it feels like there's a role there that's very explicit, which is identifying the needed investments. And it's pretty basic, right?
Yeah.
You've done that forever. But to make that an explicit, public-facing role, that then regulators and stakeholders are going to do different things with in different states. In some states, I think, okay, we're going to take that and we're going to require that the utility go out and try to procure these and run competitive solicitations. In other areas, they're going to say, you know, we want to validate that these are the right investments and have the utility do it. You know, maybe in other areas, they're going to say, okay, great, that's the size of the competitive market for these new things. You know, they're going to, every state's going to go some.
So I want to make sure we hit on a few different areas, because the focus of this conversation has been around where are we making investments, and are they investments in infrastructure? Are they non-wires or alternatives? What's the role of the utility relative to EV deployment? You know, are you a facilitator? Are you taking a more active role in that? What's the, you know, we talk about, and you hear this discussion around a platform. Is there a role for the utility as a platform provider?
It's rate based on it all. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, a friendly modification, which is I feel like we've also been talking about what is it the customer really wants, mm-hmm. right? And EVs is part of that, of
yeah.
course. But I'm curious as to what you said, Allison, right?
Alyssa.
So what do you think has broken? Is it just a general social trend that's made this difficult?
It's very focused on
because it's this old
carbon.
This old paradigm of, you know, we trust you, you're going to give us mm-hmm. affordable, reliable electricity. I would say generally your customers still think that, but this other, you're saying there's another dimension now, which is, says it has to be clean,
and we say
we don't trust you to mm-hmm. give us that,
yep.
right? Because there's all these things going on out here that we see in the news, and you guys aren't taking advantage of all these great things, right, or
yeah.
whatever.
Well, the message has very much been you can't put a price on the end of the world. I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
The sky is
But then I have the business community that as we
sure.
start shifting, they are freaking out.
No, yeah,
not publicly, though, because they don't want anyone boycotting their business, right? So they're out in the public with, I mean, it's such an odd
sure.
paradigm right now, but...
But they clearly pay a disproportionate amount of any improvements like that, so therefore
they
are concerned.
They do.
Yeah.
They do. I mean, they're very, very clearly concerned about rates, right? I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, we're doing an economic study right now. If you raise rates 10%, how many jobs are impacted in northern Colorado? I mean, I can put a number on that now.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Is it totally crazy to think that we could evolve the utility maybe back into the role of the trusted advisor, right? I mean, I want to come to you because you know more about this than anybody else. I read all this stuff, I hear all this stuff, but I trust you because you got smarter people,
right.
better models, you understand, you know, the scenarios of what might happen in the future, and I need some help in making that decision. I mean, it seems to me that mm-hmm. there's this public good aspect that originally utilities were trusted with this, you're going to give us the public good because every citizen has a right to this.
I think the public good's being expanded.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
that's kind of what I'm saying,
yeah.
I think.
That's what I'm
we've all said affordable, reliable, and safe.
Right.
That's the mandate. And it seems like at the very base level, I know for Duke in when you're talking about, you know, distribution level, distributed energy resources, we don't want to be a stumbling block for customers. We don't want to tell a customer you cannot put solar on your rooftop because we are over capacity on your circuit, or you can't do EV charging. We want to make sure that we're ahead of any of those distribution level investments that you're going to have to make in the 5-year term. And the distributed energy resources are coming. If you do nothing, they're going to be there.
Right.
And you have to be able to accommodate it. And then 10 years, I don't know, you know, maybe 10 years you can start to think about, can you make it easier for customers? Like, can you help accelerate distributed energy resources, again, at that distribution level? And the reason I'm saying that is we're definitely seen as the bad guy for that transmission or utility scale solar. We're, you know, number 2 install of solar in the country, and people are frustrated that you can't install more.
Yeah.
And we're all that's getting installed where the land is cheap in the eastern part of our state, where the customers aren't. And so we have these, you know, capacity constraints, and people are frustrated by that, and they're stuck in an interconnection queue. So we don't want that at the distribution.
What he just said sort of answers your platform question, because that is at least a big part of being a platform provider, is we will take care of you. Whatever you need, we will take care of you.
Right about it. Customers do look at us as being the trusted advisors on all things related to energy and how they use it, and what's the best way to go about the interconnection process, how can we help them do that, and so on. Because, you know, we are involved in the community, and we're kind of faces out there. We participate in a number of charities and so on. And, you know, that, so I think that's sort of an untapped potential that we have as utilities, too. I don't know for sure, because I work in the engineering at the customer areas, but I also don't think we really understand where our customers are, too, or what they're looking for, what they want. We tend to lump them all together, residential, commercial, industrial.
Right.
And then, you know, maybe we pay attention to a few key accounts and we understand them, but we don't understand our customers broadly, what they're really interested in.
When you say trusted energy advisor, what does that mean to you? What does that mean in terms of what you're... how you're interacting with your customers,
it could be, well, what could I do to reduce my bills? How could I better manage my own energy usage?
Yeah.
Up to, you know, I'm interested in electric vehicles. Help me out a little bit.
Yeah.
Help me understand them. Help me, you know, what does it mean if I plug it into my garage one-frame outlet, or should I put in a 240 volt?
You see that at Duke. You have Duke One. That's your non-reg business just spun up. That's exactly what it is. It's an energy advisor for, it does residential, but mainly commercial and industrial for the exact questions like
that. We just implemented a portal for our interconnection, so customers interested in putting solar, you know, now we've kind of made it a lot easier for them to put application. They've got a number of drop downs and, you know, references and links to kind of help them through the process, and they can track and see where their status is at. So those kind of things that we think we're starting to work on now, that can help customers better use their energy, or, you know, provide additional services. And I think there's a whole lot more of that out there we could be doing if we take some time to try to understand them and, you know, do some market segmentation.
No, we have. I mean, that's Platte River hosts our energy solutions for the cities to get some value in having, you know, all 4 roll up into one. And we spend about $12 million a year on energy efficiency alone. And this is kind of the next piece that we're
looking at. So you're managing the energy efficiency programs for your...
Yes, for the 4 cities.
For the 4 cities?
Mm-hmm. Oh. And this is kind of the next step. Mm-hmm. So we just started a vehicle charging pilot where you can buy a level 2 charger for about $200. And right now we're just kind of, you know, do it in the wild. You can do whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is that we have, you know, 225 megawatts of wind coming on our system in 2020. So what we'd like to be able to do is tell them, because the wind is at night, which is not when our load is, of course. Mm-hmm. So our idea is that we want to be able to send signals to say, hey, so now's when we need you to charge. We need some load.
Yeah.
So the idea is, again, shifting a little bit. Right. If we can match load to when energy production is at its highest.
Sure.
And you can see, like, Fort Collins, for example, has time of use rates. So, I mean, and their time of use rates are for everyone. They're relatively punitive, about 25 cents in peak, 6 cents in off peak. which is a pretty big range.
But you need that range in order to incent the behavior.
You need even more, right?
We talk about this all the time about incenting.
Yeah.
It's really about punitive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what worries me too.
And I'm okay with it though, because if you really want to change people's behavior, we can't print all the money in the world to go, here's your $5,000 for your solar, here's your this for that. It has to be punitive. You have to force customers into making those decisions. Mm-hmm. And you can see when you look at our vehicle charging, all the other three cities, they're charging whatever, right? You're seeing spikes every hour of the day. You see Fort Collins, that peak rate, 5 hours a day, there is no charging going on. It's pretty fascinating to watch.
Yeah.
But it's true. I mean, it's really more about punitive than incentivizing, because incentivizing, all you do is you allow people who are going to spend that money to collect a rebate on something.
Right.
It's when it's punitive that you change behavior.
You're asking about EVs in general and our role in promoting them.
Yeah.
And, you know, in California, there's generally not a lot of desire to see utilities actually own and operate charging stations. Yeah. But we are doing a lot to promote them. Mm-hmm. And we have now programs for residential, programs for commercial, programs for fleets. Mm-hmm. And we're basically trying to, you know, hit every potential electric transportation segment. Mm-hmm. We have a program with the port to electrify cranes right now. And, you know, the California goal is 5 million vehicles by 2030. Our goal is 7 million vehicles in California by 2030. We think that's where we need to get to, even more aggressive than where the state is. And we see that as just, you know, that's how you hit your carbon goals, because you're not going to do it if you still have lots of cars and trucks around. And so at the same time, there are limits to how much money we can spend on incentives and building out infrastructure. And so we're also, one of our focuses with the state, among other priorities, is trying to get the state to do more incentivizing of electric transportation. So we see that as really important for our long-term strategy. Of course, we have other things that are higher priority to the state, like wildfires, that make it hard to balance all those things.
Oh yeah, there's those.
If you only had clean forests.
That's right. There you go. That's
right. I think what I've started with having these conversations a lot recently is the key mile markers or metrics. Like, how do you, if I'm Duke Energy and I want to not be a stumbling block for customers installing distributed energy resources, do I measure success in terms of distributed energy resources that are installed? Like, I don't have a grasp on what the metric is that shows that you're succeeding in not causing a problem. Mm-hmm. Or like electric vehicles, like, is electric vehicle adoption, if you're not able to own the charging stations, then is it you're just making it possible for people to have electric vehicles, but you're not maybe directly making it happen? And I don't know your programs, but I think that's what I struggle with, is like, your measure of success a lot of times depends on other industries.
Well, for these programs, we do track the usage of the charging stations once they get built. And so it's not just like how many customers actually take us up on the offer to help build out the infrastructure, then we see what they're doing with it. And for some of the programs, they're required to also participate in a demand response program for the charging station. So
you do your participation rates.
What's that?
You do participation rates in those programs to measure how you're coming along. That's what I'm asking a question. I don't know.
Yeah, so it's, part of it is, I mean, the programs are all still relatively new, so the numbers we have more like installations, but as they've been around for a while, then we'll start looking at more carefully, what are they doing with them, when are they charging, are they being used? Because we want to make sure that if we spend a lot of money, obviously, to build out this infrastructure, especially the fast charging, when we're doing that, it actually gets used a lot, and so we'll be tracking that and reporting on it.
So is your hope to shift the load?
Well, so that's part of it. I mean, a lot of the EV infrastructure is just electrifying it. I mean, we want to do it in such a way that they charge, you know, in times when it benefits the grid, ideally.
Right.
But for a lot of the installations, you know, if it's like some of the earlier programs were like offices, and that's probably going to be more daytime than evening. Mm-hmm. So we'll try to manage it and
it's fair to say your number one goal right now is just get gasoline cars off the road.
Yeah.
That is the number one goal. If they then also charge in useful time, fine. But right now, I don't care when they charge as long as they charge.
Yeah, and so I think like the managing the charging is almost like a different question of supporting the infrastructure to facilitate electrification. And so like we want to worry about both of them, but the you know, that you can sort of, you got to divide the problem a little bit.
I see, your question on when it comes to metrics on hosting capacity, very different from the EV piece because, you know, so, and I agree, we struggle with it too because it's like, okay, I could certainly tomorrow say that APS's goal is now to ensure that there is always 30%, make up a number, right? 30% open hosting capacity on any given feeder. I'm going to go spend hundreds of millions of dollars to make it happen, but I could mathematically, engineering-wise, guarantee a 30% availability at any given time. But now the economics play into that, and so that whole idea of, you know, not having a queue or not standing in the way of a customer, yeah, we can do it. It comes with a significant cost, and so how do you then find a metric or a measure that is specific to where you're guessing the next customer is going to want it, right? And that's almost near impossible. So it's a very hard.
I mean, part of what
to solve.
One part that we haven't talked about as much is forecasting the growth, and one of the things that we're doing, in part because we have to do it, is developing circle forecasts for all the DER technologies. And so they're not great yet, but we're working on making them better. And so we do have forecasts for PV, EE, DR, solar, storage, circuit specific on every circuit now.
You have to do that?
Yeah.
How accurate do you think they are?
Depends which technology. So solar and EE have been around for a while, and so the propensity models that we have are more robust and have been tested and refined more. Some of the things like energy storage are harder. You can sort of use solar as a proxy to try to inform your models, but mm-hmm. you know, yeah. that may or may not work.
Right.
Using integral analytics software for doing that or something else?
I'm just curious. I'm trying to remember if we went with them or somebody else. I can't actually remember now. Okay. I know that it was like them or somebody else, but I can't remember which of they went on it. And you know, one of the things we part of what we have to do is put out integration capacity numbers for every circuit on a map that gets updated roughly, ultimately be updated monthly. And one of the questions is, should we use that number to drive our circuit planning? And there's a lot of debate about that. And some people say, yes, you know, if you have an integration capacity of zero, then
go fix it.
Go ahead and rebuild it. And right. if it is in an area where we have reason to believe there will be a lot of solar coming soon, and maybe we have to do some work on the circuit anyway, maybe you should go ahead and upgrade it and create more capacity for it so you only have to touch it once.
So a lot of these discussions have gotten to what do we need to do from a network development? What about from a customer satisfaction perspective? Where does that fit in here? I mean, are we measuring transactional CSAT related to customers that are they're asking?
Is this about contracting customer resources to help support the grid? And I know we tend to talk a lot about grid operations and so on, like, but is this included in the discussion? Is, you know, he's got solar, he's got a AAA 1547 compliant inverter and supporting grid support functions, and I can contract with him to provide services to the grid?
Could be.
I think that's part of it. I mean,
yeah, that could definitely be part of it.
10-year horizon.
Yeah.
It's more of an aggregation of multiple, right. like thousands of people, right, to make a virtual power plant. Or.
Yeah.
I mean, I think from our perspective, it's doing a better job of understanding how customers are different and want different things, and then doing a better job of creating more differentiated programs.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the future, so we have classic AC cycling programs, and now we have smart thermostat programs, and we have a few other things. But obviously with storage, you can do a lot more. And I think there are some customers that really don't care what you do as long as they don't notice it. And there are some customers that may be willing to notice it if you pay them enough. And I think there's gonna be a wide diversity in sort of the willingness of customers to be flexible and how much they're gonna demand in payment. And I think
you got it.
We need to, you know, figure out how to map those together to program offerings that are new.
We got to flip into the regulatory discussion. Okay. So we've got about half an hour left. So I'm going to run back over there because we got to help with the asset management piece.
Keep going.
I agree, though. Don't you think a lot of it is financial? So for me personally, until I hurt, I'm not playing around with this stuff. I like my house 68 degrees. I want to come in. I don't want to be hot, right? My electric bill is such a small portion of my.
Yeah.
You know, economic output.
And which electric bill compared to your cell phone bills? Every month.
It's nothing, right? I mean, Colorado power's cheap. Our power's cheap. But when it gets to a pain point, right, then people get a little more interested in participating in programs.
Mm-hmm. And well, when you say people, you're sort of overgeneralizing, though, because kind of what he was saying is there's clearly a segment of people that do care. They want solar, they want whatever, right?
Right.
But then there's a whole segment of people that are like, yeah, you, I just want it when I want it, and I want it,
right,
I want cold beer and hot showers, right,
or whatever. If it gets to a point, though, where it's financially harmful to me, then I'll have to adapt my,
yeah,
behavior. But until
now,
that
then
point,
it flips. I mean, the other thing that comes up when I'm talking to folks a lot is, in fact, I use Fort Collins, overuse Fort Collins, but I'll talk about the difference between Chattanooga, which is also a muni, and Fort Collins, mm-hmm, which is muni. In Chattanooga, it's all about tornadoes and storms and hurricanes, right?
Right?
So they've spent a huge amount of money in upgrading their circuits and being able to automatically, you know, switch circuits and all that kind of
leveraging
stuff.
Leveraging their fiber network.
Yeah, to recover from storms much more quickly. Fort Collins doesn't have to worry about that kind of stuff.
No.
Right? But in Fort Collins, you've got a segment of people that want solar, or they, uh-huh, want, you know, whatever.
Yes.
And that's what's kind of driving, maybe that's what's driving it much more than a storm recovery reliability kind of an issue, right? So it really does depend on where you're at, what the key drivers are. And in Southern California, earthquakes is a big deal, but it's, I don't know how to even describe it. It's sort of out of sight, out of mind, right? It doesn't affect day-to-day decisions.
On the resiliency front, the much bigger thing is proactive shutoffs for wildfires. Mm-hmm. And so now there's a lot of talk on backup power in California, which didn't used to really be an issue so much. But now you're seeing a lot more people being interested in getting solar and storage and having it with the backup functionality enabled, which they all do now, I think.
Yeah.
There's an education piece of realizing that you can't just plug in a battery. There's actually a lot you have to do to make that work. But people are doing it now.
Before I watch this, is anybody interested in taking a snapshot of it?
Did you take a snapshot?
I've taken snapshots of it.
Okay.
As long as you did. Totally illegible to you, but just in case.
No.
No.
I'm good to go?
But most people do anyway.
Yeah, I've been seeing you.
So now everyone's favorite topic, regulation, policy making. You know, a lot of the discussions we had today already touched on a bunch of these areas, but we know as the distribution utility transforms, you know, it's policy making and, you know, state utility commissions are going to become increasingly important. So what we're trying to do here is capture your thoughts on, you know, what's needed in the short and longer term to make that happen. Thinking about rates, thinking about, you know, federal, you know, what can federal policies, you know, wholesale market design. Just what's your thoughts on the regulatory angle of what's needed? It's so big.
I'd say there's a difference between what's needed and what's likely to happen.
How should we frame that?
If part of the objective here, which I suspect it is to come up with what are good strategies for utilities to create and execute on, then it's more relevant, well, what's likely to happen, because we don't have any authority over the commissions at Title I. So my observation would be, I think there's going to be increasing pressure, and there is now already, to have the distribution utility become more of an arm of policy. So to your observation of, like, it has been low cost, reliable power, and we're sort of adding into that this whole sector of new objectives that the utilities are being asked to perform on, whether it's electric vehicle deployment or, you know, solar deployment or whatever.
Maybe flexibility services to
balance
the grid.
Yeah, and it all sort of falls into this category of environmental or climate-related goals. Most of them. I think there's some states that just have economic development well, mm-hmm, but they're still asking their utilities to help them deliver on that, maybe as a trusted advisor. So I don't know how to answer the question of what should the role of the policymakers be, but certainly I think the regulators would most like to believe that they're somehow in partnership with the utilities to do so.
Right, okay, so think about, you know, the regulatory reform and how to align those financial incentives with these policy goals. What are some tools that we could use or are being used today? Think of, you know, performance based rate making, you know, decoupling.
I think there's just a lot of ambiguity about where we're actually going for a lot of what these resources are actually going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So in California, there's like a hodgepodge of different proceedings, looking at different DERs individually and collectively. And then you also have everything that's happening at the ISO, looking at allowing DERs to directly participate in the market. And it's not clear what's actually going to really be valuable in the long term. What functions and values from DERs are the utilities really going to want to call upon a lot versus what's more of just a pilot to see if we can do it? And you know, one of the things we talk a lot about is, so there's a lot of DERs that want to participate directly in the market, basically just not talking to us at all. And maybe that makes the most sense for most of them, and we may contract with a few of them for peak load reduction on certain circuits that need it, but generally they'll just go to the market, and our role mostly just be to make sure that those market dispatches don't cause havoc on our system. Alternatively, it could be that we're a much more active role, and we end up being in between the DERs and the market, running our own market or something that looks like our own market. It's not clear which of those is a better future right now. What we're trying to do is study and see, you know, what are the implications of different directions. You know, what would you have to believe that one version was better than the other? I think another big question to sort of looking at differently is DERs have tons of use cases to potentially provide services to distribution utility, but it's not clear which of those use cases are really going to be valuable. I mean, mm-hmm. peak load reduction for non-wireless alternatives is one clear one. Is there really more beyond that? Are we going to do a lot of
frequency?
Are we going to do frequency regulation? Voltage support, sure, but the smart inverters can do that on their own. Like, we don't really need to do much for that if that's the use case. You get into things like optimal load flow and like trying to extend asset lives using DERs. Is that really going to happen, or is that just, are the DERs just going to want to play in the market because there's more money over there?
You talk about setting up your own market. It's almost like you're talking about, we need to decide what is the role of the utility. Is it to act as this platform where you have this market running on top of it, or are you active participant in this market? Does that make sense? I mean, is that what you're trying to say?
Like, I think either way, there's some kind of platform role. It's just the question of how much of that platform role is to be conducive towards giving DERs access to the market, where they're primarily wholesale market resources that maybe occasionally provide distribution services, versus the distribution utility needs these resources so often for so many different things. They're doing so much to dispatch it that it makes sense for the distribution utility to be its own market, and then just bid the excess capacity into ISO. And I don't know which direction makes more sense at this point.
It seems like one of the things California does well, this gets to the regulator role, is the regulators demand sophisticated analysis and data, right? They're constantly challenging you to provide better analysis, better data. And it seems like that's an emerging role where regulators need to be demanding that.
But I think, going back to the data provision, there's a lot of reluctance to do the stuff that we have to do now, a lot of pushback, but it makes us do it better, right? Like people are fearful of what's going to happen when you open up the hood. The reason they're fearful is a lot of the stuff that we do, we're not actually that good at managing a lot of this stuff, and we have to do it better.
If you're going to have that platform, you have to open up the data, right? I mean, if people are going to build on top of it. Is that what you were getting at? More about, providing, be transparent with the data?
Yeah, I mean, this whole question of platform, I mean, the definition could be this broad or it could be this narrow. So those discussions still need to happen, and my guess is the platform in one state is going to be different from another state. But this idea of understanding the value of certain assets and being able to specify it in a way, sort of create the plug and play. You talk about it as apples and oranges, but it's understanding the system well enough to be able to create a market where you really are doing apples to apples comparison, and that
price signals are out on the grid, so where investment.
I mean, price signals might be part of it, but in my mind, it's more if a procurement's going out for certain assets, and you want to make sure that whatever you select actually does what you're specifying. That means you've got to be really good at specifying what you want, so you truly can do an apples-to-apples comparison.
Right.
And in my mind, that is a platform
almost like performance outcomes that you're desiring. And however you meet those.
Yeah, I mean, it's less pricing, maybe a piece of it, but it's less pricing. Text signals per se is just true valuation. So what are all the value points and how do they really measure up to each other straight out, whether it's economical, whether it's societal, whether it's, you know, grid ancillary service, I mean, any of that stuff. Right.
Well, and I agree, but even on the technical stuff, I'm not convinced that procurements that go out for storage can actually truly compare one storage technology to another storage.
Not yet.
No. But that's where we have to get to, right? Yeah. We have to be able to say...
What you got to be able to do.
A lithium ion battery that's made by so-and-so is going to perform like this, but one made by so-and-so is going to be different.
So I think for policies to de-risk the transition ahead is doing pilots or doing programs that help you get answers to some of those questions to have...
I totally agree. Totally agree.
And I think that's probably a 5-year horizon so that you can start doing more full-scale deployments of technology in the 10-year horizon.
Maybe I'm overstating this, but it's like if your regulators are saying, we want you to do storage, right? We want you to procure 100 megawatts of storage over the next 5 years, then a true platform provider, it seems like, comes back and says, in order to do that, here's what we have to do. Right, we don't have enough information about certain battery types or certain performance specs. You know, under certain conditions, are they going to perform certain ways? What's the lifetime? How often do they need to be replaced? You know, I don't know about you, but you know, I've got 4 kids that have computers, right? And every laptop is different, right? Because the batteries are different, the way they're charged is different, and one lasts a while and the other one doesn't and all that kind of stuff, right? So it seems like a platform provider has to be able to tell the regulators, absolutely, storage is valuable, but here's what we have, here's the details of what we have to be able to know in order to evaluate the true benefits of these technologies. So you're the final arbitrator in some ways of...
Do you think it's realistic, given how quickly both products and manufacturers evolve, that the utility would have time to independently study each one?
Well, that's a great point, but maybe it's part of the platform provider is being able to set the requirements that the manufacturers have to be able to meet. So maybe they're the ones doing the testing and research, or maybe you have some final validation that you put it through.
I'll give a plug for NREL. They actually do that thing where a utility wants to analyze the technology. They'll do all the testing in their labs here for that.
Yeah, I guess where I was going with it is, you know, the contracting model usually is you manage that risk with contractual terms, and that you know enough about the counterparty that you trust that they're not just putting forward a totally bogus product. But part of the model is, you know, the third party comes forward and you compare the costs, and if they don't perform, you know, they're on the hook for whatever penalties that they have. If that's not going to work, that's a different kind of paradigm, and it's sort of...
So almost de-risk it through contractual, legal performance requirements.
Acceptable specifications is kind of what you're getting at, right? Like, if we define those. Mm-hmm. And that came up earlier before about specifications.
Right.
Let me try a little bit more, which is, you know, I talked to enough regulators to know, and I won't name names, but some of them just barely understand the difference between
safe place
and power, let alone frequency and voltage and charging cycles and all these other things that go into that, right? So it's more than minimum specifications. It's really understanding the impact these technologies are going to have on the network operations. And if you're the network operator, and if you're the true platform provider, you've got to be able to be the one that has the final arbitration over how these things work and what, you know, what gets done or not. And I realize you can do some of that through contracting, but I don't think you can do...
But there's another possibility that I would put out. And it feels like, you know, part of the challenge is that as distributed energy resources come in and it sort of atomizes this challenge, now you've got 10,000 things where you used to have 100 or some, whatever it is. And maybe just what I'm hearing is you talking about you know, now we need to have visibility down to this much more granular level than we've had before. We need it down to the individual technology level. It could be that one way to deal with that is to try to have the utility step into that role to have kind of that level of visibility and control. There could also be some kind of way that policymakers could help build or invite in, maybe in partnership with utilities, others who can help aggregate that and sort of create that buffer there, so that you don't need to know what every individual device is doing, but you still have the ability to, you know, have visibility and predictability around some certain node. Whether that's how realistic that is, I sort of step away from to some degree, but I think there are certainly a lot of people on the sort of more competitive market side who would advocate that that would be a better solution, and are advocating. Yeah. So,
you know. I mean, APS, you have fires in your batteries, right? So. I thought there was two. Sorry.
No, that's like way history.
Okay. That was an old one.
Yeah, that don't count.
I know a lot of like proposals that I see, you know, around grid modernization and energy master plans. A lot of concern of regulators of how this impacts like low income communities. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I think to run a role is to kind of like balance the various interests of utilities and stakeholders and customers.
Yeah.
And also keeping the interests of the low-income communities as well, to enable them.
That is a utility's role, right? In a competitive market, is to stand, you know, to account for those customers.
I think the commission's role. Yeah, commission's role.
Commission's role.
Yeah.
In your case, it's the council's role, right?
Yes. Yes.
Or your board is.
It's our board. It's our board, who is made up typically of a UD and of a mayor.
Mm-hmm.
But that, I've worked at a regulated utility and I would agree that really should be their role. But they often are a little overreaching.
But the challenge is, yeah, so the challenge is keeping rates low.
Yeah.
And investing in infrastructure.
Right.
Exactly.
And meeting everyone's needs.
And meeting everyone's needs.
And wants. Yeah. It's a, right?
Right.
Yeah.
The utility is the whipping boy in all of this. Like, nobody's happy with the utility.
Yeah.
Industrials or, you know, business customers don't want rates to go up. Low-income advocates don't want rates to go up. Environmental organizations want, you know, more infrastructure installed. And then the commission wants everyone to be happy.
No, I guess
that's the commission's just not.
I actually don't think the governor wants anyone to be happy. They just want to be reelected.
Yeah. The governor or their constituents. Not everybody.
When we think about promoting investment, I mean, with the ITC phasing out and the production tax credit going away, the role of the federal government, what's your thoughts on that? Are those still needed? These more blunt instruments from the past? Do we still need these incentives?
I happen to think we don't, but I know.
We're going
to
find out pretty soon,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure that people don't agree with that. I do think we continue, in fact, I'd like to see more of a federal role in exploring the edge of the grid, these issues that we're talking about, right? I think, mm-hmm. you know, we say, oh, that's a state issue, but we're taxpayers and we should be helping find answers to some of these issues. I mean, and not just at NREL, obviously they're doing a good job of spending some of our taxpayer money.
Do you feel like being at NARUC, do the state regulators want assistance from the federal government, or do they want the federal government to just fuck off?
If assistance means money, absolutely.
Yeah.
If assistance means, you know,
direction,
telling you what to do,
no
way.
Yeah.
And it's a very, as I'm sure you know, it's a very sensitive line between, you know, what the federal role is and what the state role is. But.
And I think because California has such aggressive targets and is willing to spend lots of money to incentivize them, I think there is some trade-off where if there were greater federal incentives on the margin, there would be fewer repair costs going to these things without affecting the deployment. And so I sort of think, yeah, let's have more federal money because then it makes it easier for us to do what we have to do. I mean, if there's more federal money going towards solar developments, then, and we have a competitive market for solar, then the bids are going to be lower because they're going to have to compete with other people who are getting that free money too.
Not that it would encourage diffusion of these technologies, but it would lower the cost.
Yeah, and also more generally for something like electric vehicles where our position is basically we need as many as we can, as fast as we can, then I think every federal dollar probably helps with that. You know?
So almost, because the 200,000 limit, after you sell 200,000, that the federal incentive gets cut in half. Like Tesla just got, it was 7,500, now it's 37,500.
Right, so if that were going to go away.
You're going to have to bump it up, right? I mean, obviously.
Or you make it punitive. It's a carbon tax, which, you know, everyone says they want to decarbonize, but even Washington State couldn't pass a carbon tax. And nothing should ever be punitive. But if you're serious about these goals, why isn't it $5 for every dollar to register a gas vehicle in a state with carbon goals?
In Europe, yeah. I mean, but
I'm saying if you want to be real about it,
I mean, in this country,
you almost have to get punitive, right?
Everyone's real about it when it means spending money that gets taxed implicitly that they don't actually see any numbers showing up in their balance sheet or their checkbook anywhere. I mean,
even
I think
the O&G majors are split on that carbon tax.
I'm having trouble keeping my kids in line at home, and I'm guessing that you've got some great parenting.
Think if you are serious about this, though, and you really want to say we're serious about this and we're going to get serious, then it should be punitive. If we're saying that electric vehicles are the future and that's how we decarbonize and that we are heading to a tipping point of climate that we cannot return from, the earth will not be inhabitable, you will see sea levels rising, you will see agriculture at a steep decline where there is not enough food, if you are real about this, then get real about it. Because if you want to change people's behavior and switch them from a gas car to an EV, and an EV costs a little more, right? It does. I mean, you can see over the lifetime of the vehicle, great, people don't look at that, people go, okay, now. Some people do, most people do not, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you get them? You say, it's $500 to register an EV, it's $5,000 to register a gas vehicle. You want to use the fast lanes, EV goes free. I mean, when you lived in DC, I lived in the DC metro area when they had the HOV3, you could pay to use the lane, or you had a HOV3, or you could have a hybrid vehicle.
Right.
And what did you see happen in the metro area?
They sold a lot of Priuses.
A lot of Priuses.
They did that in China, and people would swap the badges on the car. It was a gas car, but they had like EV badges all over it.
And the world has to get serious about it, right, though, as well, because when you look at the coal plants that they're building in Vietnam right now, I mean, they are some of the dirtiest, least efficient coal plants we have ever seen. But everyone's like, oh, well, it's okay.
So they'll be operating for 50 years, too.
When you're talking about like a vehicle registration fee, I don't know about in Colorado, but in North Carolina, you'd have one issue that's so stupid but is unavoidable is Department of Transportation versus Department of Environmental Quality versus the commission. And who has jurisdiction?
Oh.
And the state government, it's going to take 10 years for them to get things figured out in their heads to say who's responsible for figuring. So that would probably be Department of
Transportation. You pay a 7% tax on your vehicle when you buy in the city of Fort Collins, right? Mm-hmm. Sales tax, well, gas vehicles, it's 20%. Electric vehicles, it's 2%. I mean, we're always all about adding the money to things where we try to make things cheaper.
I don't disagree, but culturally we would much rather make a different choice less expensive than a choice more expensive to start with.
Are we moving the needle?
No.
So I think one thing, going back to what policies would do the transition, one thing that I found with California's many, many regulatory proceedings is the ones that seem to work the best are where the commission sets out a very clear, specific goal and then gives the utilities a lot of flexibility to figure out how to get there. And the ones that work the worst are where the commission sets a very ambiguous goal and then really micromanage the process and how to get there. And we've had lots of both. I think.
So it's almost like a clear vision.
Or just like an objective. And so a lot of times the commission will say, like, do this new thing, but it's not really clear what the thing's supposed to do.
Right.
And so then you fight with the stakeholders about how to build it, because some stakeholders want to do this thing and some stakeholders want to do this thing. And then instead of actually figuring out how to build it, you just fight about what you're actually trying to do. Where the commission just says, we want you to build this thing to achieve this objective and have this capability.
Right.
Then we can say, all right, here's the best way to get there.
Because you can't say clean, because if you say clean, then you got the nuclear comes in with the nuke, right?
Well, that's not going to happen in California anymore.
Yeah, because it's all the politics.
And I think, you know, more generally, ways in which the commission can try to sort of nudge us to do better at what we do, because I think there's obviously lots of places where we can do better. Transparency being, I think, one thing that can help us get better. I think that's helpful for us. Conversely, there's also times where the commission just asks us to do stuff that's just extra work or extra cost. It doesn't really improve anything. Sort of hard to generalize how you're in one category about the other, but that's something I'm thinking about as we talk about sort of what the impact is and the policies on us.
Yeah. Any clear objectives is important.
Yeah.
And I think being responsible for coordinating stakeholders to some extent, so that you make a decision and then you're not having it appealed by half the parties, whatever proceeding that was, and then you're working towards something that is still technically under appeal and you don't know for sure what'll happen. I think if they're able to bring some consensus, that helps.
If you can.
Yeah.
All right. I think we'll have another minute. Any last comments on this topic?
What's the right answer?
C.
B. Is it C now?
It's
C. It was B.
I think it's get out of the way.
Get out of the way.
It's punitive.
It is punitive.
That's what I got out of it. So.
Yeah. I'm never getting elected to anything. I know.
You know how that works when you run for office.
Never getting elected to anything. Yeah. I know that.
All right. Well, thank you. We'll take pictures. How do we preserve our knowledge?
Keep those up there. I'll take a photo of that. We'll take those away.
Okay.
And it was great listening in, and hopefully some of these messages can sort of surface up into our report and move the needle, as you put it. Not easy, but at least we're trying.
Mm-hmm. It's a good cross-section. I mean, we only have, six states represented?
Brad, everybody needs to go quickly.
Okay.
So what Jeff said, he's not going to bother asking the question again, but he wants to pull the result of the first one.
Okay.
Is that easy to do?
Yeah.
Because we need to wrap up, so whilst people wrap up, maybe you work on your slides?
Yeah.
You can just unplug it so people don't get to see what you're doing. Get out, and then, so we don't need to do the question again.
Okay, we don't need to do the question again.
Did you figure it out? Oh, is that okay?
Let me unplug then for a second.
Pretty similar. I think it's a little bit funny.
Thank you.
Are you okay? Can I help? Sorry, just...